Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, January 10th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midland College President to Retire. Steve Thomas celebrated as he announced his plan to leave post in August. By Ben Schaffer. Steve Thomas, Midland College's fourth president, announced Monday his intent to retire in August. Steve Thomas has been a gift and blessing to our community, Scarborough Foundation President Grant Billingsley wrote. He's a team player who works to find beneficial solutions to complex matters, with Midland College often leading in innovative ways. He's built a strong team that is focused on meeting community needs. We will miss his leadership, but wish him all the best in what comes next. The college wrote in a news release that Thomas led the college in several new milestones, including early college high school at Midland College, the MCMISD College and Careers Academies, a pre-kindergarten academy, two new bachelor-level degrees, the Texas A&M Concho Engineering Academy, the Primary Care Pathway Program, and a new enrollment management system that includes a guided pathways approach to assisting students to make informed choices about their college careers. On behalf of Midland ISD, I would like to offer my congratulations and appreciation to Dr. Thomas on his retirement from Midland College, Stephanie D. Howard, new superintendent of MISD, wrote. Under his leadership, the young people of Midland have had a tremendous champion. From the 900-plus MISD students enrolled in dual-credit classes to the nationally recognized early college high school at Midland College, to Pre-K Academy at Midland College, Dr. Thomas has been a strong partner and friend to the students of Midland ISD. I appreciate his leadership, dedication, and willingness to develop strong programs and partnerships to benefit students, and wish him the best in his next chapter. Thomas also oversaw several new building projects, including renovations and upgrades to the L.G. Langford Chaparral Center and the new June and Frank Cowden Jr. Dining Hall, according to the news release. Before he retires in August, two new capital projects will be completed, renovation of the Jack E. Brown Dining Hall into the Jack E. Brown Conference Hall, and the new Pre-K Academy and Center for Teaching Excellence. Thomas began his community college career at Midland College in 1976 when he taught psychology courses as an adjunct instructor. In 1979, MC's first president, Al G. Langford, hired Thomas to teach full-time. He continued working at MC until 1987 when he was hired as a dean at Lexington Community College in Lexington, Kentucky, and then as chief instructional officer at Victoria College in Victoria. From 2000 to 2008, Thomas served as president of Vernon College in Vernon and Wichita Falls before returning to Midland. I was lucky to find a career path that has been so enjoyable and rewarding. But after 47 years in the profession, it is time for a new chapter in my life, Thomas said in the news release. Our daughter Lindsay was born here, and my wife Vicky and I will always cherish our time in Midland. I want to thank both the Midland community and the community of Fort Stockton, where our branch campus is located. Thomas highlights at Midland College. In his second year as president, in fall 2009, Early College High School debuted with 125 high school freshman students. The high school, which is on the college's campus, allows first-generation college students who may be economically disadvantaged or minorities the opportunity to receive a high school diploma as well as an associate's degree, according to Midland College's website. A $3 million renovation project on the Al G. Lankford Center. The project included the installation of elevators. The Midland College softball field opened after more than 4 years of planning and construction on February 16, 2011. The Midland College Firefighter Academy was built at the Harris Field Fire Training Facility in the summer of 2013. The 2,400-square-foot facility includes classrooms, engine bays, men's and women's locker rooms, kitchens, and offices, according to the college. Midland College became a state leader in cutting-edge mathematics curriculum. The MathWays Project received an exemplary award from the Texas Success Center Math Pathways Project. The Primary Care Pathway was a partnership developed between Midland College, Midland Memorial Hospital, and the University of North Texas Health Sciences Center in October 2015. The program allows West Texans to earn a Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine degree in just 7 years, the college reports. In winter 2015, the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board approved a new degree at the college, a Bachelor of Applied Sciences in Health Services Management. Midland College partnered with Concho Resources and Texas A&M University to form the Concho Texas A&M Engineering Academy in February 2019. Engineering students can enroll at Midland College for the first or first 2 years of college before transferring to Texas A&M. In fall of 2019, Midland College established a pre-K academy in partnership with Midland ISD and Midland Development Corporation. After 2 years of construction, the college opened the June and Frank Cowden Jr. Dining Hall. The 18,600-square-foot hall was added to the Scarborough Student Center. This article is entitled, Boil Water Notice, Past Crises Prepared Cities Response, by Stuart Doreen. Toward the end of the city's press conference Saturday about the rescinding of the Boil Water Notice, Midland Mayor Patrick Payton joked that his wheelhouse had been crisis. The COVID pandemic, a winter storm unlike any other, and the Boil Water Notice supported that claim. As it turned out, previous crises helped the city this past week. We have had several close calls at the utilities department, and the freeze really put us in this position of knowing what to do in these situations, Utilities Director Carl Crago said. But luckily, back in February 2021, when the freeze happened that week, the City of Midland didn't have to do a boil water notice. But that's what put all this in place. Who my emergency contractors were and who my emergency suppliers are, to get things rolling at a moment's notice. Payton talked about COVID being a benefit post-pandemic, with Midland County stepping in early with an emergency declaration. It was an emergency management practice that local entities became used to during the pandemic. We already knew how to bring that emergency management together through nearly 2 years of doing that, the mayor stated. So, as negative as the pandemic was, it put us in a position to know how to operate through this. Payton also added this about ending his 3 years as Midland mayor with the boil water notice. We started with one, we're going to end with one. But through it all, really the main thing is I just happened to be sitting in the seat. It was really the people around me, our city staff, our city manager's office, and the citizens of this community. All I had to do was just go along and make sure that we all had a good attitude. And we kept pressing toward the goal of being who we are and doing what we do. So that's unique. I kind of wish they could have waited till next week to have this crisis, but here we are, and now we're out of it. This article is entitled, Blong Looks to the Future in Swearing-in Ceremony. New mayor says leadership is about unity, not unanimity. By Stuart Doreen. Lori Blong was sworn in as Midland's mayor Monday inside a packed ballroom at the Bush Convention Center. Blong was one of three City of Midland elected officials sworn in during the event. The others are new District 4 Representative Amy Stretcher-Burks and returning District 3 Councilman Jack Ladd. The three won election in November and will join District Councilman Scott Dufford, District 2 Councilman John Norman, and at-large Councilman Robin Poole and Dan Corrales. The first meeting with the new council is Tuesday at City Hall, 300 North Lorraine Street. Blong takes over for one-term Mayor Patrick Payton, who chose not to seek re-election. She addressed the challenges she expects with the new council, stressing that leadership is about unity, not unanimity. Echoing a sentiment first offered by Payton earlier in the event, she talked about the different perspectives of the council, including race and wealth. She said there will be disagreements between the council members, something probably expected based on the 2022 election cycle, but that the seven want what is best for Midland. Prior to Blong's comments, Ladd expressed his excitement for Blong serving as mayor, stating, "What kind of a mayor will Lori be? She is one of the best people I have ever met." Addressing Blong, he added, "If you put 50% of your capability into the job, you will be one of the best mayors Midland has had." Blong told those at the Bush Center that improvement in the city will happen when people invest in their community and decide that their respective place is between your own two feet. A lesson she said she picked up during a family and life conference in 2018. She said that Midlanders can help make a difference by being involved and being a community of individuals. The oil company executive said Midland is a wealthy community, and if money could fix a problem, that it already would have been fixed. She added that problems with governance and education will be solved when people take the time and make the effort. Blong said, "That means knowing your neighbor just doesn't mean knowing the person living next door, but across town, and being there to help meet everyone's needs." Blong talked about her four foundational principles for city government: taking care of the people who work for city government, the finances of the City of Midland, the city's infrastructure, and city facilities. She said once those are cared for, the leaders could look to take care of economic development and quality of place projects. "We are committing to caring for those four things," Blong said. But again, Blong talked about community, much like she did during the campaign, and the needs facing Midland. Items such as health care, education, and mental health. It may have caused some to remember Priority Midland, a community-wide effort that lost steam because of the COVID pandemic. "You need to commit. Join us in the arena. Invest in your community and decide that your place is between your own two feet." This article is entitled, City Officials: Water Response Close to Ideal, by Stuart Doreen. The City of Midland described its response to the boil water notice last week as pretty close to ideal. On Saturday morning, city officials were on hand to tell the community that a 36-hour water crisis ended. But even more, they were allowed to celebrate good news, that city workers worked incredibly hard, residents were resilient, and a bad situation didn't get worse. It was pretty ideal the way people came together, Mayor Patrick Peyton said. We've seen numerous things we've had to deal with, but when something like this happens, the way people stepped up as fast as they stepped up, it's really a rare occasion. I hesitate to say that it was ideal, but it was pretty close to ideal. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality confirmed City of Midland customers no longer need to boil water before drinking, cooking, and making ice at around 2 a.m. Saturday. Utilities Director Carl Crago said bacterial samples taken throughout the city came back negative, meaning there wasn't any bacteria in the system. The boil water notice impacted residents, businesses, restaurants, and even schools. Around 2 p.m. Thursday, City of Midland officials alerted the public of the need for the boil water notice, a result of a 30-inch water main damaged during construction, causing the main to rupture on Tuesday. Later in the week, an automatic level indicator for the reservoir suffered a mechanical error, and the reservoir was drawn past its low intake point, allowing the pipe intake to pull in water mixed with a large amount of lake debris that settled at the bottom of the reservoir. The operators were focused on water levels in the tanks and distribution system and did not notice that dirty water had entered the treatment process and overloaded to the point where a plant shutdown was necessary, the city reported in a news release. Residents were then told that water consumed needed to be boiled, as it was pretty much like lake water at that point. City officials then described a community-wide effort that included county officials stepping up immediately with an emergency declaration. Businesses like HEB and Market Street stepped up to provide water for distribution. The West Texas Food Bank helped coordinate those water and food distribution areas, and the city of Odessa was in communication about assistance it could provide. City leaders also credited workers who worked tirelessly to fix the main. Crago said that the lack of available workers in the community kept workers at the site for longer periods of time and sleeping in their cars to get some rest when they could. This article is entitled, Council to Vote on Traffic Signal Project at Site of Fatal Collision, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council will vote Tuesday to authorize city staff to manage the design of a traffic signal for the intersection at Mockingbird Lane and Magellan Street. The Northeast Midland site is the location where a teenage girl riding an electric skateboard was hit by a vehicle on January 1st. The 14-year-old succumbed to her injuries. Design efforts for the development of the traffic signal will take approximately 6 months to complete, according to the city. The City of Midland agenda states that $150,000 will be transferred from the general fund to a project account for the purpose. Not long after the fatal collision, an online petition was started to add a traffic light and crosswalk at the Northeast Midland intersection. As of Monday evening, there were 1,018 supporters of the petition. The Reporter-Telegram noted, citing the petition, that city staff started a study on the addition of a light on January 5th. This process included installing counters to figure out the extent of traffic at the area, according to the report. This article is entitled, La Mesa Woman Dies Following Collision on State Highway 349 Over Weekend, by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. A 76-year-old La Mesa woman died Saturday afternoon following a collision in far north Midland on State Highway 349, according to Midland Police. MPD reported that at approximately 1:36 p.m., officers with the Midland Police Department responded to the intersection of North Highway 349 and Maverick Lane regarding an accident involving three vehicles. The investigation revealed two vehicles, a Chevy crossover traveling in the inside lane and a Honda Civic traveling in the outside lane, were side by side northbound on Highway 349. MPD reported. The third vehicle, a Ford F-250, was traveling westbound on Maverick Lane and failed to yield the right-of-way at the stop sign while attempting to turn north into the outside lane of State Highway 349. The truck was hit by both vehicles that were traveling north on State Highway 349. MPD reported that the driver occupying the inside lane of State Highway 349, Mary Manriquez Estrada of La Mesa, was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital, where she later succumbed to her injuries and was pronounced deceased at 4:25 p.m. MPD also reported that a citation was issued to the driver of the Ford F-250 for failure to yield the right-of-way. Next of kin has been notified, and the investigation is ongoing, according to MPD. This article is entitled "Craddock Box at Federal Well-Capping Funds" by Amanda Drain, Houston Chronicle. The state's Railroad Commission won't accept $300 million in federal funding to plug abandoned oil wells until it knows if there's a catch, Commissioner Christy Craddock told energy executives Friday. "We're going to wait to see what their rules are before we decide if we have the opportunity to accept those dollars," said Craddock, who chairs the commission regulating the state's oil and gas industries. "If we do, you'll see us plug a lot of wells. If we don't, we're going to continue going back to the legislature to make sure we have enough dollars to meet those priorities." In her speech, Craddock called the federal regulatory climate hostile to energy and urged legislative work to be undertaken to keep utility bills down. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled "Texas Adds Over 2,000 Oilfield Services Jobs" by Kyra Buckley, Houston Chronicle. Employment in the country's oilfield services sector continues to rise, but remains below pre-pandemic levels as companies compete for workers in a tight labor market. Oilfield services jobs in Texas, which leads the nation in sector employment, rose to 317,031 in December, rising by 2,486 jobs compared with November's 3,014,545 tally, according to preliminary federal data analyzed by the Energy Workforce and Technology Council. Employment in the sector ticked up nearly 9% for the year, up from 290,951 Texas oilfield services workers in December 2021. Oilfield employment was at 650,587 nationwide in December, an increase of more than 52,000 from a year earlier, but still about 50,000 workers shy of the pre-pandemic level in early 2020, according to the group. "The trending increases in hiring is encouraging for our industry and workforce that was forced to make significant reductions in 2020, said Leslie Beyer, CEO of the Energy Workforce and Technology Council. "The oilfield services industry is still adding jobs, but at a slower pace. In a recent survey of energy executives by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, some oilfield services firms said it's becoming harder to find qualified employees. Attracting and retaining labor remains our most significant and intractable challenge," one oilfield services executive wrote in the comments section of the survey. "Despite wage and benefit increases, retaining newly hired labor is difficult." This article is entitled "Corn Belt State's Ethanol Push May Drive Up Fuel Costs" by Jennifer A. DeLuy and Chunzi Zhu, Bloomberg. some Americans could end up paying more for their gasoline thanks to a plan by 7 Midwestern state governors to boost the use of corn-based ethanol. Their request is under review by the federal government. If adopted, it could be good news for corn farmers throughout the region, including the politically important state of Iowa. But it would also force oil refiners supplying the Midwest to provide a specialized gasoline grade and construct new storage tanks and other infrastructure. That has the potential to increase costs, which would likely be passed on to consumers already squeezed by soaring inflation. Prices at the pump are seen rising by at least 2 cents per gallon in affected states, according to a study by consultancy MathPro. Though some industry groups say the costs could be much higher, especially if the change is implemented this summer, leaving little time to provide adequate inventory. That risks undoing some of President Joe Biden's historic efforts to tame runaway gasoline prices, which his administration regards as a major political threat. The average cost of a gallon of regular is now well below the $5 plus peak seen last summer, but prices have been creeping higher again recently, gaining more than 19 cents in a 2-week period ended Friday after a winter storm disrupted oil refining. It's the latest example of how Biden's desire to quash inflation is proving difficult to reconcile with other goals, such as keeping a politically important constituency happy or his green agenda. He has made repeated pleas to the oil industry to increase output to help guard against surging pump prices. But that has angered environmentalists and even the fossil fuel producers themselves. U.S. oil refiners have cited a slew of operational and policy constraints, including capacity cuts made during the pandemic, as reasons why they could do relatively little to boost gasoline supply last year when fuel costs jumped. Ethanol boost. At the heart of the push to boost ethanol is the special treatment given to E10 gasoline. It's the most common variety of the fuel in the United States and contains up to 10% corn-based ethanol. It has also been granted a federal waiver to exceed a limit on its so-called volatility, which is a measure of how much it evaporates, a phenomenon that contributes to air pollution. The farm lobby would prefer consumers use E15, which, as the name suggests, contains 15% ethanol. But despite having a similar volatility to E10, it doesn't enjoy the same type of exemption. That has effectively blocked sales of the higher ethanol blend across much of the country during the peak summer driving season, when elevated temperatures mean speedier evaporation. And while more than 2,800 U.S. gas stations sell E15, the hassle of complying with the summertime limits has deterred other retailers from offering it. To create a level playing field and give E15 a better chance, the Corn Belt leaders are trying to handicap sales of E10. The governors of Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wisconsin petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency in April to stop giving E10 a partial waiver from air pollution curbs in their states. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine submitted a separate request later, while the governors of Kansas and North Dakota rescinded theirs. The White House is reviewing the EPA's draft response, which could be released within weeks. The EPA has little discretion to completely deny the governor's request, though the agency can postpone the change for at least a year and renew the delay for 2 more if it concludes there is insufficient gasoline supply. Refiners and pipeline operators, including Flint Hills Resources and Magellan Midstream Partners, are lobbying the administration to delay the shift until at least next year, arguing a too fast pivot threatens short-term fuel supplies and an even higher price spike. Because it takes time to move from refinery to retail, refiners are generally reconfiguring and adjusting refinery production in February and March to be able to produce summer gasoline, said Patrick Kelly with the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. Ethanol supporters insist the oil industry is exaggerating the potential disruption. These are sophisticated companies that have been operating these systems for decades or more, said Renewable Fuels Association head Jeff Cooper. They know how to run multiple products through these systems and how to make changes quickly. The EPA already tried using regulation to extend the volatility waiver to E15, but a federal court tossed it out after a legal challenge from oil refiners. And legislation that would enshrine the change in federal law is unlikely to clear Congress anytime soon. This article is entitled, U.S. Rejects First Offers to Replenish Oil Stockpiles, by Jennifer Jacobs and Ari Natter, Bloomberg. The Biden administration is delaying the replenishment of the nation's emergency oil reserve after deciding the offers it received were either too expensive or didn't meet the required specifications, according to people familiar with the matter. The Department of Energy rejected several offers it got for a potential purchase in February, said the sources, who asked not to be identified as details of the process haven't been published. The department outlined its intention in December to begin restocking the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, starting with a purchase of 3 million barrels next month. The plan follows the historic 180 million barrel release of oil from the reserve ordered by President Joe Biden as he sought to tame high gasoline prices in the aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The department will put off the purchase it had originally planned for next month, but its program, which used a new approach that accepts fixed-price offers, will continue, one of the people said. The Biden administration had planned to start buying crude when it dropped to around $70 a barrel. Oil fell during the fourth quarter, and U.S. benchmark prices fell close to those levels last month. DOE has put forth a long-term plan to transition from release to replenishment, and we're committed to doing so in a manner that provides a fair deal for taxpayers, the department said in a statement Friday. DOE will only select bids that meet the required crude specifications and that are at a price that is a good deal for taxpayers, it said. Following review of the initial submission, DOE will not be making any award selections for the February delivery window. The SPR, the world's largest emergency supply, was created in 1975 in the wake of the Arab oil embargo. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, The Speaker Race Doesn't Matter, Results Do, Representative Pfluger, by Stuart Doreen, editor. The fuss over the Speaker of the U.S. House was much to do about nothing. Was it government at its worst? It isn't. From time to time, a little back and forth isn't a bad thing, even when it is intra-party. We can say that about local elections, when on Monday no one was talking about commercials or campaign back and forth when city officials were sworn in. And it won't matter when Republicans take over the House. The grand old party's inability to do anything substantial won't have anything to do with the fact that it took Kevin McCarthy 15 rounds to become Speaker. The border is a problem. The long-term debt of the United States is a problem. Our commitment to wars abroad is a problem. Spending more money than we have is a problem. And our broken entitlement system is a problem. McCarthy won't lead us toward a solution on those. Republicans, like Democrats, have no interest in coming up with solutions there. It reminds us of every time former Congressman Mike Conaway would come to the old Reporter-Telegram building and update us on what was happening in Washington. At the end of every discussion, I would ask about the surging debt, and every time he would shake his head. It didn't matter if Republicans were in control or Democrats were in control. I asked the question, and his look of disappointment was the same. McCarthy will be no different, and when our new Congressman August Pfluger comes back to Midland, his head will shake the same. In a letter to constituents, Pfluger stated that he supported McCarthy, quote, because of his positions on energy and border security, unquote. He added, when it comes to the border, he exposed the scandal of known and suspected terrorists crossing our southern border and has called for Secretary Mayorkas to step down or be impeached. I am pleased that the reforms that many of us in the conference have called for have been made, like guaranteeing a check on our spiraling national debt and ensuring every district in the U.S. has a stronger voice in the legislative process. We will immediately set to work drafting legislation, holding hearings, demanding accountability, and ensuring the safety of our homeland. We will see. I am not holding my breath that McCarthy, who once called for social media bans of Republican colleagues, will make much of a difference here. The good news for McCarthy and Pfluger will be they will continue to have excuses, whether it is a conservative wing of the party they can't control, a Democrat-led Senate, or a Democrat in the White House. Even if Republicans were to gain control of the House, Senate, and White House in 2024, future proposals would have a little less bite. The deficit would still grow. No meaningful reform will happen with entitlements, and we will continue to spend money we don't have abroad while neglecting needs at home. I hope I am wrong. And if I am wrong, I will gladly write an opinion piece about how wrong I am. I hope Pfluger's faith in McCarthy has more to do about his ability to lead and less about being McCarthy's hand-picked successor to Mike Conaway. Congressman, you are no longer in the minority party. The time to lead is now. The time to take steps in the right direction is now. Lay the groundwork for 2024 immediately. Give Americans a reason to believe conservatism can work. Make people scratch their heads that McCarthy was once 0-for-14 in bids for Speaker, and that you voted for him every time. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, January 10th. Imogene Vines. Services for Imogene Vines of Midland are scheduled for 2 p.m. Tuesday, January 10th, at Bellevue Baptist Church. Graveside services will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Visitation was held from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Monday, January 9th, at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Imogene went home to be with the Lord early Friday morning at her home of 72 years. She was born Christmas Day of 1923 in Bishop, Texas, to Elmer and Treaty Cole. She is survived by her children, Sandra McCaskill of Midland, Dale Vines and wife Nancy of Midland, Johnny Vines and wife Sandra of Midland, Cheryl Casbeer and husband Will of Greenwood, Jody Vines and wife Becky of Midland, Mark Vines and partner Tony Panion Jr. of Blackwell, Texas, Cindy Goodman and partner Bobby Merriman of Blackwell, Texas, Tracy Vines and wife Sherry of Midland, Stacy Vines and wife Robin of Midland, her brothers Tommy Cole and wife Colleen of Snyder, Lanny Cole and wife Madeline of Midland, her sister Oleen Mason of Branson, Missouri. She is also survived by 28 grandchildren, 60 great-grandchildren, 20 great-great-grandchildren, and a host of nieces and nephews. Imogene was preceded in death by her parents, Elmer and Treaty Cole, husband Troy Vines, son Greg Vines, sisters Irene Monk and Inez Kasten, brothers Lawrence Cole and Johnny Cole, and grandson Josh Vines. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Michael Braskett, April 15, 1949 to January 5, 2023. Michael J. Braskett, 73, of Big Spring and formerly of Midland and Lubbock, passed away January 5th at Scenic Mountain Medical Center. A funeral mass will be held at Holy Trinity Catholic Church in Big Spring at 10 a.m. Wednesday, January 11th. Visitation will be held at the funeral home on Wednesday morning from 8 a.m. until 9:30 a.m. Interment with military honors will be held at 3 p.m. Wednesday, January 11th at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Lubbock. Michael was born in Columbus, Ohio on April 15, 1949, and was retired from the United States Air Force. Michael was preceded in death by his parents, Harry Braskett and Betty Paget Braskett, his first wife, Marilyn Jones Braskett. He is survived by his wife, Nancy Johnson Braskett, his daughter and son-in-law, Beth and Jody Fortner, his son, Scott Braskett, a granddaughter, Abby Fortner, as well as his siblings, Donna Welch, Kathy Braskett, Steve Braskett, and Mary Ann Potts and her husband, Jeff. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials to Happy Day Humane Society, P.O. Box 2009, Big Spring. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Pat Holt. Patsy Lou Holt, 87, peacefully entered her heavenly home on January 6th while surrounded by family. Pat was born in Ira Ann on May 12, 1935, to George T. and Elsie May Aaron Pogue, and was the oldest of three children. Pat is survived by her son Danny Holt, daughter Deanne McGraw, son-in-law Kyle McGraw, son Rusty Holt, and daughter-in-law Patty Holt, all of Midland. She is also survived by eight grandchildren and four great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her loving husband, Ken Holt, her parents, George and Elsie Pogue, her brother, Neil Pogue, and sister, Sandra Keith, and great-grandson, Lincoln McGraw. The family will receive friends from 6 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, January 10th, at Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral services are scheduled for 2 p.m. Wednesday, January 11th, at the Golf Course Road Church of Christ Family Center. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Midland Christian School. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Sandra Sandy Sledge. Sandra Sandy Lynn Sledge, 65, of Midland, went home to her Heavenly Father Wednesday, January 4th. Sandy was born January 5th, 1957, in Alpine. Sandy is survived by her husband, David Sledge, of Midland, daughter Shelley Cunningham and husband Kyle of Midland, son Sam Sledge and wife Helen of Midland, sister Kim Harmon of Arlington, brother Kyle Harmon and wife Sherry of Mansfield, father Gordon Harmon of Mansfield, grandsons Silas and John David Sledge of Midland, granddaughter Ella Cunningham of Midland. Sandy is preceded in death by her mother Freddie Harmon, sister Sharon Wartz, father-in-law Jean Sledge, and granddaughter Faith Ann Cunningham. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, January 12th, at the branch at Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. A celebration of Sandy's life will be held at 1 p.m. on Friday, January 13th at Stonegate Fellowship. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that contributions in Sandy's honor be made to Rexana's Foundation for Fighting Lung Cancer at https://rexanasfoundation.org. William Beaumont Slattery. William Bill Beaumont Slattery, age 87, traveled over to glory on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2022. He was born April 27th, 1935. He was survived by five children: Joseph Martin Slattery, Mark Beaumont Slattery, Matthew Robert Slattery, Marcia Sue Thomas, and Michael James Slattery, as well as eight grandchildren and 17 great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his wife of over 50 years, Dorothy Slattery. Together, they are dancing again on the streets of gold.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is January 10th, 2023. City Council votes, again, for terminations. Odessans blast mayor, others for lack of transparency. After hearing comments from eight concerned residents, the Odessa City Council once again voted 5-2 to terminate City Manager Michael Marrero and City Attorney Natasha Brooks without explanation. On December 13th, newly elected council members Greg Connell and Chris Haney voted along with Mayor Javier Hoven and fellow council members Mark Mata and Denise Swanner to terminate Marrero and Brooks. The action prompted a lawsuit by local civil rights activist and attorney Gavin Norris, who complained Hoven declined to allow anyone to speak on the matter prior to the vote being taken, despite it being properly noticed on the agenda. Last week, Ector County District Court Judge John Schrode filed a temporary restraining order against the council, voiding the vote. However, the judge lifted the order once Monday's council meeting was scheduled. Many of those who spoke expressed bewilderment about the vote, noting it took place during Connell and Haney's second council meeting and just 2 months after Marrero and Brooks had been evaluated. They also expressed dismay. Hoven signed a $338,000 contract with T2 Professional Consulting the day before the terminations to assist interim city manager Agapito Bernal. No one spoke in support of the council or the terminations, although a handful of those in attendance had applauded the council's actions on social media and compared the actions to those of new presidents who appoint new cabinet members. Those who voted in favor of the terminations repeatedly ignored texts, voicemails, and emails in the days leading up to the vote and in the days immediately afterward. Hoven canceled a scheduled January 9th interview last week, citing Norris's lawsuit. Swanner and Haney were the only council members who addressed those who spoke at the meeting, but they did not offer an explanation for the terminations. Instead, Swanner told former city council member Tom Sprawls that despite what he said, she did not evaluate Brooks in October. She also took him to task for discussing something that took place in executive session. Haney took exception to City Council member Steve Thompson's characterization of his Christian faith. Good evaluations. Sprawls, who did not seek re-election in District 4 and finished his term in November, said he still wants to know why the pair were fired. He claimed Mata gave raving reviews for Marrero in October, and Swanner gave raving reviews to Brooks and said Hoven didn't speak at all. Mary Willis, who also did not seek re-election and finished out her term in November, said she was pleased to be at the meeting because the mere fact it was scheduled proves that what happened in the December 13th meeting was wrong. She said Hoven, Mata, and Swanner announced when they were elected in 2020 they wanted to get rid of Marrero, and she realized a year ago they were grooming Dan Jones to be the interim city attorney. They had no reason to fire Marrero and Brooks, however, and now there's a mass exodus of people who are afraid they'll be fired if they don't acquiesce to their desires, Willis said. You guys sat in a meeting with me to evaluate these two positions, and you agreed they'd done a good job, Willis said. The council skipped over Assistant City Manager Aaron Smith in favor of former Billings and Collections head Agapito Bernal, someone who you now have to pay to train to be an assistant city manager or city manager, Willis said. Smith could easily have moved the city forward without having to pay more than $300,000 to do so, Willis said. He was not even considered, in my understanding, for someone who was not properly equipped nor meets the standards of what the job application says should be the qualifications for city manager, Willis said. Willis also took a swipe at Hoven for complaining about staff members speaking out of school. The mayor often speaks about leaks. If it's something that you're proud of, you can stand up and be proud to stand behind. It's not a leak, it's a fact, Willis said. Hypocrisy. Willis said she was appalled Haney and Connell didn't even study the facts before voting to terminate the pair, despite owing an obligation to the people to do so. Mr. Haney, you took my place, and I thought that my district was in good hands. I expect you to study. I expect you to not just be a cookie cutter for the mayor and these other councilmen. You're above that. You're smarter than that. You say, this is the day the Lord has made, and he's given you the opportunity to make the right choices and to do the right things. Later in the meeting, Willis said, I believe that when we say that we are Christians, that we should do that in word and in deed, and that includes treating people fairly, giving people a fair opportunity, and I don't think that's being done. Several people clapped when Willis said the fact Connell and Haney fired the pair indicates to her they can't stand on their own and therefore shouldn't be sitting in their seats. District 2 Councilmember Steve Thompson, who along with newly elected District 3 Councilmember Gilbert Vasquez voted against the terminations, also brought up the matter of religion. He said he was never consulted about who should be named the interim manager or interim city attorney, nor was he consulted about the T2 contract that was apparently negotiated prior to Marrero's firing and signed the day afterward. I don't believe we're being honest here. Mr. Haney spouts Christianity every day, and I find it hypocritical that he doesn't live by what he says. And that goes for everybody else, too, Thompson said to claps. Haney immediately responded, I am a very Christian man. I don't make any decisions unless I pray to God. I did not make any decision unless I pray to God, and I cannot believe you called me out on my Christianity, sir. I beg your pardon, but who I am, who I am. I'll second that, Connell chimed in. And I'll always be that, Haney finished. Lanes, NAACP President Gene Collins said city councils can typically get what they want done if they have the votes, and he doesn't think city managers and city attorneys are roadblocks, especially when city council members stay in their lane and city managers and city attorneys stay in theirs. I think because of the last 2 years, you haven't really done anything that you are using them as scapegoats, Collins said. When people don't agree with someone, Collins said, we sit down like mature men and women and discuss them. That's how a city works. You don't come in with personal agendas, Collins said. You may have personal preferences, but it takes all of you to decide what's best for the constituents that you have met with and you have discussed these issues. He's getting calls from all over Texas and from the NAACP headquarters in Washington, D.C. about what's going on. There are lanes in which we operate, and Mr. Mayor, I hope you will recognize and respect those lanes. I would hate for a criminal investigation because of impropriety to be cast upon this council, Collins said, drawing claps. Norris said, although he was glad to be given another opportunity to speak, his lawsuit will continue moving forward. He also promised more litigation. It shouldn't take us threatening you to file a lawsuit, actually filing a lawsuit, for you to do the right thing. That's what we've elected all of you to do. If you're hell-bent on not doing that, we'll keep filing lawsuits when we tell you that we have at least three other lawsuits we're going to file. We're going to file, Norris said. Norris also asked how Haney and Connell could fire Marrero and Brooks, being so new they didn't even know where the bathrooms are at City Hall. You don't get rid of good people just because you don't like them, Norris said. He also said he expects Marrero and Brooks to be paid for December 13th through Monday's date, and there will be a lawsuit if they aren't. Fair representation. Odessa and Angie King told the council there's no logical explanation for the terminations. There is no documentation of Marrero's having shortcomings. There is no information available to the public that reveals any sort of incompetency. In fact, there is no information available to the citizens of Odessa that offers any explanations as to why Marrero would be terminated, King said. She flat out asked Hoven if Districts 2 and 3 matter to him, since Vasquez and Thompson were not consulted about the T2 consulting contract. She said he avoided even discussing the contract during last week's City Council work session. The city has various serious and real needs, and yet the council isn't addressing them, King said. Odessa resident Gary Dutchover, who referred to City Council meetings as King Hoven's court, expressed dismay. Hoven recently said, the city used to have a strong manager, weak mayor form of government. We can do anything better. I agree with that, but that's not the way it should be, at least not without our consent, not without our knowing what we need to be doing, Dutchover said. I just really want to come and say that this has been a circus. We need to be working together. We don't need to be partisan. We need to be making decisions based on what we want. You guys work for us. I've been in the service business forever, and this service is not what I want to pay for. Austin Keith, who said he has served on many boards and found Marrero and Brooks to be professional, expressed concern about the monetary costs of the terminations. He suggested the council wait until Haney and Connell had a chance to get to know the pair before taking a vote. What we are signing ourselves up for, our mayor signed off on a $300,000 plus contract. What's it going to cost us overall in this process right now? Because I'm kind of worried here. We've got this group here that wants to cut money and not spend money, but yet now we're going to spend money and we don't even know what the final cost will be, Keith said. Savannah Morales, who recently lost in a bid for Ector County Commissioner's Court, said, the city council and their followers have done nothing but cause division and problems within the city. It's painful to see what's going on, but you know, a wise man once said, be careful who you let on your ship because some of those people will sink it if they cannot be a captain, Morales said. Morales then gave a warning to Hoven. You stated to me that I would not win my campaign because I don't have the money. Well, I can guarantee you will not win your next campaign in 2024 because you will not have the support, she said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.